Got it.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Amana podcast. Amana, once again, is a collective of people, places, things, and actions that transcend us, and looking at people's higher virtues and your value systems and how that leads your life. And today I have the pleasure of having Scott Arnold with us. Say g'day, Scott.
How are you going?
And you'll notice Scott's got a similar accent to myself. We're both Aussies and grew up, funnily enough, in the same kind of neighborhood. He went to my brother's school or high school, that of Woolooware. I went to probably an opposing one, Endeavor High. Yep. But certainly we grew up in the same area and we belong to the same golf club in Australia, and that's how we met. So thanks again for being here, Scott. I'm not going to do one of the things I don't do on this show is a big bio. So we'll just have a conversation and these things will come out. So to kick it off, let's talk about some of your values. You have been an exceptional golfer, still are an exceptional golfer. Some of your value systems, when you've gone out and played golf or growing up playing golf, what are some of the things that you valued about golf or about, you know, the life that it's brought for you? Maybe just touch into that'll be our starting point.
Yeah. Well, like I grew up playing. My father was the pro at Cronulla for 30 years, and my older brother played. And I joined the club there when I was 11 years old. And I think at first it was like, it's, I played rugby league as a kid, and it's not something that I sort of wanted to do, was to be a golfer. It was, you know, my parents didn't really want to see me get hurt playing football because I was still so small and all the other kids are so big. So I just, you know, I didn't really have a choice. So started playing golf, and I just naturally got really good at it sort of early. And, you know, I think as a young kid, I think being around older men all the time and not being around sort of kids I sort of didn't get into trouble as a kid because I was always either at school or going to golf, or, you know, or going home. Like, I didn't really have sort of a night life with friends. And like, I did have friends that, you know, I'd go surfing and stuff with, but I think golf always drew me back into, you know, learning how to grow up pretty fast.
Yes.
And I think being a young kid and being able to, you know, interact with older people, and I think that sort of stood me down the line. As like, I can remember a few girlfriends I had actually at the time that were like, oh, my dad's like really hard to get along with. And I'll be like, oh, he'd be all right. He's not that hard to deal. I'll be fine. This and that. And, you know, you'd go in and you'd have a chat and straight away you'd just click it off. And I was like, because I wasn't scared of like older guys because I'd been around them my whole life.
Yes.
So I think it was easier ways to connect that way. And then they'd be like, oh my God, he really likes you. So like, he's never really, like, no one's ever been like that before. And I think it sort of, for me, it stemmed me in the right sort of direction in life, being good with people, being able to understand people. And, you know, as a young kid, you know, a lot of young kids get spoiled and, you know, get to do sort of whatever they want, but they sort of miss the, you know, the things about like communicating properly with, you know, people and, you know, how to treat people, how you want to be treated. You know, a lot of people, I think golf in a sense in that way, when you're a kid and you're dealing with older people all the time, you sort of learn those values pretty early on.
Yeah, and certainly golf has a lot of rules and etiquette of how
it does
how you approach someone. And one of the ways that we started working together, you know, doing some mental coaching. But before we get to that, maybe speak a little about how you got into competition golf and kind of how you got playing tournaments and how that path opened up for you.
Yeah, so I played – this was a junior at Cronulla and played a few junior events here and there, but sort of later on, I didn't really get into sort of competition golf. I couldn't put an age on it, but played a couple of junior. I played an Aussie junior, so I must have been under 18. And then finished school. I actually got offered a scholarship at Georgia Southern, and I actually didn't take it. It was like a half scholarship because, you know, at that stage of when I was playing, I wanted to play for Australia and I wanted to play for my state, and, you know, I wanted to do all that stuff first. I didn't want to go to college and, you know, I just finished school. I don't want to go back to school is the way I sort of looked at it, and I've still got to pay to go. So if I had a full scholarship, I probably would have gone.
Yeah, that's right.
But, So in that sense, I didn't go, and then I, you know, I was fortunate enough to make the state cult team for New South Wales, and then got into the New South Wales Institute of Sport, and then just sort of progressed from there, just, you know, playing that way. They send you to bigger tournaments, and then I made the state team, and then, you know, you make the Australian team, and then you start getting sent around the world playing events that pretty much you are really the pinnacle of what you can play as an amateur. And, you know, for me, fortunately enough, I played pretty well, and I had a really good opportunity, and I was lucky to play, you know, well enough at that time that it sort of propelled my amateur career, you know, right to the top as far as I could go. So in that sense, it was great because everything was obviously getting paid for by other people, and, you know, you can just go and play golf, and it was a lot less stressful.
And you stationed yourself over in Europe for a while, correct?
I did, yeah. I was there from 2009 to 2016. I came home about middle of 2016. I came home. So I was about 7.5 years I spent over there.
And what was that like?
It was good. It was hard at first. Obviously, I was living in it. It was the first time I'd sort of lived away sort of from home for so long.
Yes.
I've been, obviously, as an amateur, when you go away, you know, you're away for sort of 3 months or whatever, but then you obviously come home. But being away from home and really only coming home for Christmas and maybe a couple of months a year was, you know, the first probably 2 or 3 years of that. That transition was pretty hard living in the UK. It was obviously a totally different demographic to Australia.
Mm-hmm. And so this,
by the end of it, I loved it. And I actually miss the UK actually now. Like, I actually really, by the end of it, I actually really liked living there. It was, I actually really liked that. The weather wasn't obviously great, but, you know, when it was a nice day there, it was amazing. It was so good.
So there's obviously in those earlier years the challenges. I think a lot of people when they first move away have those challenges, college or wherever they go, if it's into professional sports, but in particular being in an individual sport, you know, where you got to pull your own socks up every day, that could be really challenging. What kind of, if we go back to the virtues or values here, what kind of kept your head either straight or looking up, going, you know, I can do this and this is going to lead to greater things? What kept you together?
Well, at the time when I first got there, I had, I had 8 starts on the European Tour. At the time, 1 I played as an amateur, the first Irish Open. So I don't really think I was even thinking about that. It was more like, I was just away playing golf again.
Right.
And it was not until, I think, 2012 when I got my main tour card. I'd been playing in Asia from 2010, 2011, and playing on the Challenge Tour in the UK. So I was still living in the UK at that time and just traveling back and forth. But then in 2012, when I had a full card in Europe, it was a lot different. But coming back to the sort of values, is like, well, this is my job. This is, you know, what I've chosen to do. So, you know, I'm not going to live in Australia and play 5 events and fly home and then fly all the way back. It's not logical at all.
Yes.
So, and I had my mum's half Maltese, so I had a Maltese passport as well. So it made it a lot easier for me to actually be there, having a European passport. So that, in that sense, that was good. And I'd met a lot of great people over there that, you know, I, you know, got to live with, and, you know, I've got some bad advice from people that sort of really harmed me in a way, but, you know, they're the lessons that you learn, I guess, when you're young, and, you know, things, when people offer you things at the time, they seem a lot better than probably what they are. If I knew what I knew now, to, if I was in the same shoes now and I got offered the same thing, it'd be a lot different story.
Yeah, I was going to mention that for young players coming through, or even people who have an interest. You know, people call it, you know, living inside the ropes or playing with inside the ropes. But some of the things that go on, not that we have to dive into the devil's pit, but it is so important to have a great support team around you, particularly in individual sports, because they're the ones who are going to, one, be hopefully be keeping you positive, and two, supporting you, whatever their roles are, if it's that of a manager, if it's that of a financial person, or if it's that of a swing coach or a mental coach. These are the people that you're relying on to, you know, to give you these positive traits or positive transference. And so, yeah, if you've got a leaking bucket in all of that, that can really throw you off. So, you know, some of that decision making, what happened to you with some of that decision making?
Well, at first I was actually, in 2009, I just missed, well, I don't even know how I missed playing Eisenhower Cup, which is the biggest sort of amateur event you can play as a team for your country. Mm-hmm. And the year before that, we'd had the guy that got, who was number one ranked in Australia, got automatically picked. That was Matt Griffin at the time. And I was second in the rankings at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in 08, they got picked. I'd beaten the other two players in every event in America and Australia. And my world ranking was higher than them, and they got picked before me. Right. So it sort of ticked me off a bit.
Well, it's some politicking, isn't it?
Yeah, and Golf Australia were like, you know, you'll be the reserve. And I was like, I'm not being the reserve. I said, I'm not going down there and sitting and cheering them on. You know, bugger that. I should be playing.
Right.
You know, look at the results. And, you know, the excuse they said to me was, oh, well, Rowan and Tim, who the other two guys that got picked, have both won Australian amateurs. And I was like, well, good on them. Can't bust eggs at the moment. Well, what's that got to do with anything? So I think it really fueled me up, I think, for 2009. And I went out and I won Lake Macquarie Amateur, which is a really big event. I ended up winning the Australian Amateur as well. But I just had a year where I just went absolutely crazy. Like every single event that I went to, I was just like, either winning or finishing second or third. I was just like,
did you have a prove it to them in you? Like, I'll stick it to you a little bit.
Oh, well, I actually had the last laugh, really, because I really pretty much got to the stage where, you know, no one was beating me. Like, I was turning up to tournaments and I'd walk onto the putting green and I'm like, you guys are wasting your time. You're not going to win this tournament. I'm winning it. So
that's great confidence,
you know, and it was just like a confidence that I haven't ever had that confidence again still to this day. And the tournament at Lake Macquarie I won, I was actually playing with a mate of mine. It's actually a really good field. Like the UK send out players, the Scottish team send out players. So it was a very big deal back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember playing, and I think I'm not sure if I was one behind or even maybe level or something with a mate of mine playing. I might have been behind, actually. And I don't know why, I just knew. I thought, if you're going to win this tournament, you got to get going. Like, you got to start doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And I birdied 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. five holes in a row. And I was like, that'll do it. And then I was playing up to coming up the last, and I hit a good tee shot off the last, and I, you know, I was walking down, and I think I had like a two-shot lead at the time, and obviously knew I was going to win the event, but I was like, come on, let's just, pardon me, try and finish off right, and end up hitting it to about 3 inches.
Oh, wow.
For my next shot. So that really sort of set an exclamation point. And then that just ran into a few other tournaments. Riversdale Cup, which is another big event. I finished second in 09, but I won in 07, I think I won it. Or mm-hmm. I won it. But I finished 4 shots better than the year that I won it, and I still didn't win.
Yeah, right. So
I was a bit filthy with that. Then I won the Aussie Amateur. And it would have been the only golfer in Australia to win the 3 events in the same year. And I won 2 of them and finished 2nd in the other one. So that would have been like a really good achievement if I could have done that.
Mm. Now, is that what put you number one amateur in the world at that? Was that that time?
That would have got me up there. But the year before that, when I did pretty good in Europe. Finished 2nd at St Andrews in the Lynx Trophy. That sort of jumped me up a little bit as well.
Right.
And then, when I came back home, then that sort of really propelled me up the rankings. And after the Aussie Amateur, I was, number one in the world. And then I had a big trip sort of planned for we had to go to New Zealand to play a Trans-Tasman Cup. I think it was like Australia, New Zealand versus and South Africa and Argentina. I think we sort of played like a round robin event down in New Zealand, and we won that. And then we played the New Zealand Amateur, and then I had a plan. New Zealand Amateur at Titirangi, I think it was called, the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up actually getting beaten in the semifinals, which was really disappointing. I got beaten on the 4th playoff hole.
Mm.
Make it to the final. Right. And sort of when I finished, I was pretty gutted because I sort of knew that that was going to be my last event, really, because, well, I didn't know it was going to be my last event. I obviously planned to go to Europe because I really wanted to win the British Amateur when I was an amateur, and I was playing, and I went and played at St Andrews and played my first British Open at Turnberry.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I want to win this event, obviously, with, being able to get in the Open and get into the Masters. And, it was just something that was on my radar. And at the time, being number one ranked amateur in the world, I thought going over there with the confidence I had, I was probably, obviously you've still got to play well, but it would have been the perfect chance to try and, do that. And once I got back from New Zealand, I got a phone call from a management group in the UK that said, I've been following your progress. We would like to see, you want to come over and play some events and this and that. And I was like, I don't want to turn pro yet. I want to play the British Amateur. I'm going to America to play this and this and this. And they said, he actually called me back the next day and said, I've got you 7 starts as a pro confirmed.
Yeah. Tempting. And
yeah. So I was like, well, okay, that's something to think about. And then he said, you'll play the Irish Open as an amateur and you'll get into the Scottish Open. You're going to play French Open. You can play the Dunhill Links. You're going to play Kran, Switzerland. You're going to, so it's just like, the tournaments are just like, you're going to play a Dutch Open. And I was like, geez, these are all like big events.
Yes.
And I'd spoken to a few people and they were like, you're crazy if you don't take this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, obviously I was just a kid. I was only like 22 at the time.
Right.
23 at the time. I'm like, I don't know, like what's going on? So, I ended up having a chat with a few people, and then Golf Australia got in contact with me and they were like, oh, we don't want you to turn pro yet. We want you to stay and we want to send you here to play this event. And
So you had all these choices coming at you at that time, which is, you know,
but I had no one really directing me and no one that had been there and done it to tell me. And I think I was a bit naive at the time and I was like, well, Golf Australia, you screwed me over last year for that. I'm going to fucking screw you over. I'm turning pro. So they pretty much come back to me and said, well, what are you going to, stay? I said, no, not, I'm turning pro. See you later. So pretty dumb decision really when I look at it now, because I went to Europe still as an amateur, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time I was number one amateur in the world, was number one ranked amateur in Australia. And I was literally on the biggest high. I'd been playing so well for, you know, the whole year. And I agree to turn pro. I fly over to the UK. I get put in this house with, you know, just I'm living by myself at this one stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it never really dawned on me. Like, I'm like, well, what's going on here? Like, I haven't, like, I've turned pro. I haven't got any sponsors. I haven't got any, like, I turn up to the Irish Open and I'm, at the time, McIlroy was in the stable that I was in with Ernie Els and a few other, obviously big players, one of the biggest groups in the UK.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first day I'm there, I'm walking into an event and I'd played obviously a couple of Aussie Opens and that and New South Wales Opens as an amateur here in Australia, but it was nothing compared to a full-blown European tour event.
Sure.
And I was hitting balls with McIlroy and in between McIlroy and Patrick Harrington.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm there and I'm shitting myself.
You've made it and you're shitting yourself.
Pretty much I was shitting myself. And I was just like, I've gone from being the big fish in the little sea
mm-hmm.
to being the tadpole in the ocean.
Yes. Like, and you felt that way, huh?
In a matter of 2 days.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's just like the whole thing was just like I'd been flown over there and just dumped into this position where it's just like, well, there you go, go play. And
go suffer. Swim, huh?
Yeah, what? What's going on here? Like, and it was just the dumbest thing that I've ever done. And to think that the two number one ranked amateurs in the world before me were Ricky Fowler and Danny Lee.
Right, right.
And they didn't sign up and get no contract money.
Yeah, so they had a different path, huh?
So,
that was presented to them, obviously. And,
right, exactly. So, yeah. Like, you know, when I look at it now, it's like the guy that was managed, I'm not going to name names, but yeah, the guy that signed me was like, well, you know, for him, it's a win-win. Like, if I do well, then it's great. He'll get a percentage and, you know, whatever, whatever. And if I don't, then he'll just ride off on tax. So it's nothing to do with him.
Hmm.
So it's like, well, but for me, I'm abroad, living by myself, traveling to these tournaments. I've got no money. And it's like, well, what's going on here? And then, you know, I ended up getting to the stage where I was still with the management company, but I was just getting starts here and there in Europe and playing a few mini tour events and come home. And I played really well in Australia when I came back home and had my card here, had my card in Asia, and I was playing in Asia and I was playing well. And then I got my card in 2012
mm-hmm.
and still same thing happened again. Hardly got any sponsors. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, what are you guys actually doing? Like, you're taking a percentage of my prize money, but you're not doing anything for me. And
not real representation.
No, it wasn't at all. And I ended up having a terrible year in Europe. And I was just like, you know, what am I doing? Like, it was just, I literally got to a stage where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, this is ridiculous. So
you think you got towards, because it sounds like the the world parted for you, meaning it's like, here you are, you've arrived. And yet, where do I step? And no one's guiding me here. I mean,
that's exactly what happened. I had no one with experience say, no, Scott, don't do that. Don't do anything until you get, until they line you up with contracts, tell you where you're going, tell you what they're going to do for you, organize your cars and all this stuff. And it's just like,
Can really crack a person, and it sounds like for yourself mentally, where you do lose that confidence. Your mental game starts to shatter at the wrong times.
No, exactly. From the middle of 2009 when I turned pro, from then, I really didn't feel like I had my confidence back until 2015. Mm. That's how long it took.
Yeah, right.
So I was nearly 5.5 years in a hole, in a spiral where I was just like, and then I went to Q school and I got my card back, but I qualified every stage. I went first stage, second stage, third stage and got my card. And
where was that, Scott?
In Europe. So I got my card and I was like, they've got to do something for me now. Like, come on, I've got my full card again. Like, I've got to get something. And I get a phone call from the manager and I was like, surely you can get me some sponsorship now. Like, and they're like, oh no, well, it's hard to get your sponsorship because you're a little known Australian in Europe. That's what their excuse was.
Yeah. So hence we're not helping you.
So I was like, yeah, okay, so, well, I'm going to leave. He'd had a couple of deals. I found out in the end, I had a couple of sponsorship deals. Actually, I was wearing a logo from a golf club, actually. I agreed to, it was £30,000 at the time, which is, quite a good bit of money, really, to get you going.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, when am I getting this money? Like, what's going on? And he kept saying, oh, he hasn't paid you yet, and this and that. I'm like, hasn't paid me yet. And I'm like, what's going on? So, I played like 2 or 3 months. And I'm like, what's going on? And all this time, I pretty much just had a credit card from the management group that were just paying for everything. Like, I wasn't paying for it. Like, I'd pay for the stuff, obviously, when I made money. But obviously, I'm racking up a bill with this management company because I didn't really have the funds to really travel. And so I'd sort of played and made some money. And then comes down to, I was just like, well, where's this money? And he's like, oh, he's gone bankrupt, the golf course. And I'm like, you're kidding me. Like, what is going on? And then I end up finding out that he actually got the money, but he'd been gambling it, trying to make it more to make more money, and he lost it. So it came to the time when I went to the office and I was like, this is not working, this is ridiculous, like, you've lost my money, this and that. And then I said, I'm leaving, I'm not continuing my contract and this and that. And he ended up sending me a letter and said, oh, you owe me £25,000 or something. And I was like, well, you owe me 30, so you can scrap that, I'm not paying you.
And no, but this is a real, what a test that you've been through, Scott, on so many levels. And I've certainly seen you play golf. And I think recently you shoot the lowest round at New South?
Yeah, in the medals. Start of last year, shot nine under. 64, yes. Lowest score ever since the club's been open, which is good. And
that's amazing achievement. Anyone who's played New South Wales, so I think it's particularly if the wind's up, it is one of the harder courses on the planet. On a calm day, it's still challenging, but just goes to show that you, with all the talent there, and with your, even with the confidence, sometimes taking some decisions with pathways, these things can just test so much of you. And in essence, has really, I certainly don't want to say ruined your career, but it's certainly put a huge curveball in it,
massively. It has, like, I wouldn't say it's ruined my career, but it's gone pretty close to.
Yes. And
realistically, it's made me a better person, and it's made me a stronger person, I think, because, you know, sometimes I think that, like, you know, what would have happened if I got a big contract? You know, would it have been different? I don't know. And I'll never know that.
Yeah. Well, and now I think probably now being a new father and a new husband has probably put some different things in perspective for you, probably just on a life scale as well, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's not all about you. Yeah. You know, not to say that not it's just the nature of the sport that it does make it all about you.
You know, you to be honest, you have to be selfish. If you're not, you know, if you're not selfish and you're not doing it for yourself, then there's no point you doing it. There's no point going away for, you know, 8 months a year and just think, oh, and just go and play. Like, no, you know, you've got one job to do, is to go and play golf and to win tournaments. As simple as that.
Yes.
But
well, it is simple as that. And
when you have kids, golf is the last priority. I don't even get time to go practice anymore, let alone. But I've got a putting mat in my garage that I use at night time when the kids are asleep. That's about as close as I get to going to golf at the moment with COVID as well. So it's not great. But
we're in very different times, as we're discussing before this podcast. So we'll see where things come out of all of this, because the world has certainly changed, and it's changed everything with from sports to, you know, society itself. But the one thing that I'm getting from this podcast too, and the part of our, you know, without going into personal stuff, but a lot of our discussions that we had through our sessions was very much, I think, how you can make these best decisions. How do you set a clear roadmap with a strategy? How do you check it along the way? So it's not you just flying blindly. And how do you, you know, I guess, vet the people that you're looking to support you? You know, I think not only for your own decisions now, but other people coming through, you'd be an amazing resource for, you know, how to look at these decisions.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of, there's been a lot of players, you know, here and sort of a lot of young kids that sort of come through and, you know, obviously try and, you know, offer them as much advice as I can really because, you know, realistically I sort of learnt the hard way. So, you know, it's been nice that there's been a few guys really especially there's a couple of guys at the golf club and, you know, one of them.
Yes, I started working with one, I recall.
Yeah, he's turned pro now.
Oh, has he really?
And, like, I sort of had a chat to him and he's like, I'm over playing amateur golf. And I'm like, well, mate, playing pro golf's not easier. It's like, if anything, it's harder. I said, you haven't achieved anything as an amateur. You haven't won anything. You haven't made any state teams. You haven't played an Australian team. You haven't played well in any events. What makes you think that you can go and play a tour event?
Mm.
So, you know, he got, to be fair, he went to Q school and he got his card. So, like,
yeah.
And, you know, I actually spoke to him about a week ago and he was up in Queensland playing about a sort of month run of pro-ams and he's like, I can't do this. I don't even know how guys actually do this. And I'm like, I'll try to tell you, but, like, you know, it's you know, people have the perception of pro golfers and they just look at guys that are the best players in the world, like flying private jets and
being
covered around and making, you know, $30-40 million a year. Like if you look at like guys in America, but like if you actually take the top 30 guys away and go from there down below, like for me, when I was playing in Europe, like obviously I was a nobody really. Mm-hmm. And you know, your expenses are like $3,000-3,500 a week. That's pounds.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, you're looking at say $5,000 Aussie a week playing in Europe, pretty much with hotels, you need hire cars, you know, you got your caddy, you got your food, you got your flights, you know. So it's like, you know, people don't realize that what the cost is just for the average guy.
Yes, trying to get through.
Yeah, trying to get through. Like,
yeah.
it's not all obviously mansions and private jets, but it is for some.
It is at the top. Yeah, you know, that's the lure.
And that's exactly right. That's the lure.
And many a man have fallen from that. So
yeah, and it's amazing now, this day and age, of, you know, how many young kids are good.
Yes. Like,
you know, even the more that, well, for me, since I've sort of been home and played a little bit in Japan and just playing in Australia now, and obviously wanting to get back overseas, but it's just hard now with COVID, trying to, you know, Q schools not being on, and obviously having a family and having to leave a family behind and all that stuff. So it's just like, it's a little bit difficult at the moment, but
yes,
you know, obviously I want to try and get over and start playing again and do it different, would be nice. So I don't have that in the back of my mind thinking, well, what could have been, you know?
What could have been? Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I've got in our conversation, Scott, and getting to know you, I've got that faith in you and a huge supporter of who you are as a person and as a golfer. So I thank you for this conversation, and I'm sure we can have more to come. So as the world opens up again.
That would be great. I'd love, looking forward to catching up again, actually. It'd be nice, go for a hit. Hopefully in the States one day, it'd be nice.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun. A lot of fun. It's we will. Time will tell, I guess.
Time will tell.
But thanks very much, Scott. And maybe we have more of these conversations.
Not a problem. Whenever you want another chat, just let me know. More than happy to help.
Very good. Thanks so much, Scott. And I'm sure for our listeners, you know, this is a great, Scott's just a fantastic person, fantastic golfer. But more than that, the lessons that he's learned along the way, I think, are really invaluable for a lot of people, not just for Scott's journey. So something to really tune into around your decision making, around once you do have the talent and some of the rewards. You know, what does the whole picture look like, and who am I talking to? A trust is a huge thing when it comes down to these things. So,
sure is.
Thanks very much, Scott. Ciao for now.
Thanks, mate.
Bye.